Welcome back to American Scene, the show where we talk about movies with American in the title and what they have to say about American identity, culture, and values. Today on the show, we're visiting the Pacific Northwest for spooky season, and I'm happy to welcome local Pacific Northwest filmmaker and executive director for Endhaven Productions, Jason Wilkinson.
Hello.
Jason, tell us a little bit about yourself. Yes, hello, hello. What have you been doing? What have you been working on?
Well, thank you for that awesome intro. I've been working on a lot of short films the past few years. The pandemic, you know, kind of put a crinkle in some plans, but yeah, day to day, I work with several ad agencies and commercial companies on writing, directing, producing commercials and industrials for various companies and clients. But on the horror side of things, I'm very involved in the local community making horror films. It's been a passion of mine since college, and I've, you know, kind of teamed up with some folks here that really, really enjoy the genre of horror.
Wonderful. And how long have you been in the Pacific Northwest?
Almost a decade now, which is pretty great. I originally come from Oklahoma, center of the country. Yay.
And what do you like about the Northwest? I mean, at least as it pertains to horror, right? I know you always tell me it's like, it feels so atmospheric. It's like,
it's pretty amazing. I'm a tree guy. I love the tall, you know, Douglas fir trees and the kind of spooky mist we get between the trees up here, the where the rivers run through. These vast forests and mountain ranges. I tell anybody that visits here, it's a filmmaker's dream because you have a big metropolis city in Portland / Vancouver that's an hour away from anything you can think of. You're an hour away from a beach. You're an hour away from a desert. You're an hour away from a mountaintop. You're an hour away from deep, deep woods. So any exterior you could think of in the genre of horror is here. you can find it. You can find caves. You can find lakes. You could, you know, so it's quite a plethora and of different exterior backgrounds you can use and different ways to tell a very, very spooky story.
And we're going to be talking about some of that today. Both the city and the country and the woods versus a more urban environment. So we'll be talking about that pretty soon. We've been film buddies, and specifically horror movie buddies for a while, and now we're getting to the end of October. Besides the movie we're going to talk about today, what have you been checking out? And you know, there's so much out there now. I feel like you know, horror is always this genre where it's so cheap to make. Yeah. That there is just so much out there, and we've got Shudder, and we've got Netflix, and we've got classics to watch, and new stuff in theaters that's coming out all the time. I don't know if you checked out The Exorcist, the new Exorcist.
I haven't yet. I want to. Contrary to popular belief,
I was not inclined based on his Halloween movies.
Oh, this is where we're different. I love them. Okay. I love the Halloween films.
That's a different podcast. Great.
Yeah, different
that's
podcast.
A different episode. But what do you like to watch, and what have you been watching, and how do you decide what's on your list?
Gotcha. Well, I'm a creature of habit in the way that I am a fan of creature features. That's my go-to sub-horror genre. But that said, I'm really digging the new wave horror scene right now, like Ty West, Jordan Peele, Dan Trachtenberg, Mike Flanagan. Anything Mike Flanagan touches, I seem to fall in love with. Currently watching The Fall of the House of Usher. Prey, Smile are a couple of films that I really enjoyed in the past couple of years. Anthologies are another thing that really, you know, I appreciate. So and a recent one was The Mortuary Collection, which can be watched on Shudder. It kind of flew under the radar for a bunch of people, but that is some quality horror filmmaking right there. So go check out that one. Yeah.
Nice. And did you watch that recently, or what have you seen recently?
I recently, I did revisit it already this season. I do that. I watch stuff over and over and over again. So I just watched Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, the Guillermo del Toro produced movie from 2017, I think. I'm not sure. That date's probably
yeah.
wrong.
Yeah, I remember it. Yeah.
But yeah, so that was fun, you know, just revisiting all the horror films that, you know, maybe I've not watched over and over and over again this season. Yeah, that's kind of it.
Another Guillermo del Toro produced movie, actually, The Orphanage from a while back. I don't know if you ever watched that. Do you remember that?
Yes.
So my friend hosts a movie night, and during the month of October, we have five Tuesdays, and she hosts on a Tuesday night. And everybody who is in attendance submits one movie to watch, and we'll pick three out of a hat on any given Tuesday and vote on which one we want to watch. But I submitted The Orphanage because that's one that I have not seen in a very long time and remember really, really loving it. Mm-hmm. So I hope that it gets picked. I hope we get to check it out.
Yeah, man. That'd be cool. A fun one.
Yeah, so we both like rewatching horror movies and revisiting stuff that maybe we haven't seen in a while. But what are you excited to see next?
Oh, man. So there's one that's getting a lot of buzz right now called When Evil Lurks. It's a foreign film. It's been tearing up the film festival circuit. And I guess it's another take on like a possession film, but it's supposed to be pretty, pretty gonzo, bonkers, awesome. Another one that's kind of cross-genre is A Haunting in Venice, which is, I think, the third installment of the Hercule Poirot trilogy that Kenneth Branagh directed and stars in. That looks pretty cool. And then I have yet to see it, but I know it's out on Prime right now. Totally Killer is supposed to be some fun horror. So those are kind of the three that are on my radar right now.
Yeah, Totally Killer, a horror movie with some nostalgia baked in, which, you know, kind of informs a little bit of it. It's a different tone, of course, but definitely informs some of our conversation in terms of folks living in another era.
Yeah.
The reason you and I are talking about this movie today is because, you know, the Pacific Northwest has been your home for a long time, and this movie takes place just a short seaplane ride from Seattle. We're talking about the 1988 film American Gothic.
I can't fix it. I think we better check out this island, see what we can find.
What could be more inviting than a return to the past?
Hey, you guys! Look at this!
It's like we just walked into the 1920s.
You guys, I think we better take it easy, huh?
That's all right, children. Been meaning to get rid of them old things anyhow.
These are the backwoods where time has a way of standing still.
Please don't wake up, baby. I'm going to be 12, and I'm going to have a birthday party.
But what harm could you come to playing with the children?
Celebrating its 35th anniversary this year.
Wow.
In which a group of travelers make an emergency landing on an island in the Pacific Northwest after their seaplane malfunctions, and they stumble across an isolated and psychopathic family. This is directed by John Huff, who also directed, and I'm only saying this for the benefit of my sister, Escape to Witch Mountain and Return to Witch Mountain, the originals, not the one with Eric Von Detten. just had to note that. Those are two movies I should definitely revisit. I think I own them, actually. But American Gothic was written by Huff, Burt Wettinson, and Michael Vines, starring Oscar winner Rod Steiger from In the Heat of the Night, Yvonne DiCarlo, who appeared in dozens of movies and in The Ten Commandments, most notably, Sarah Torgov, Janet Wright, Oscar nominee Michael J. Pollard from Bonnie and Clyde, and William Hootkins, who folks will obviously remember as Porkins from Star Wars.
Right. And Lieutenant Deckard from Batman 1989.
Oh, okay. A film I have not seen in a very long time, but I'm sure I will. And that would have been just a year later, right?
Right. Right.
So, yeah. Good times for William Hootkins. Let's just start from the top. What did you think of this movie?
Nice. Yeah. Overall, I really enjoyed it. Before revisiting it for this podcast, the last time I had seen it was in college. So it was kind of watching it anew because I didn't quite remember everything. It is a mixed bag. It's got some decent acting. It's got some bad acting. It's got pretty nice cinematography the whole time. Definitely a professional and well-knowledged crew worked on this film. The story and the writing, we'll get more into that, I'm sure. I think for the time, it was on par with a lot of stuff we were seeing at the time. But with today's standards, I don't think it would hold up. Maybe for an independent film or something along those lines, but not something a studio would put out right now.
Yeah, there's definitely a fun idea here, but mm-hmm. I thought, in as much as the film looks good, and some of the acting is, they're doing the best they can with
right.
some pretty poor writing. I just thought, kind of executed pretty lazily. Like, mm-hmm. I like the idea of using these childlike games to kill people, but like, there's no gore, most yeah. notably at a time when this is much later on in like the Freddy movies. And yeah. there's been a bunch of Halloween movies and Friday the 13th movies at this point that go much more over the top in terms of their gore and their kills. So it's just weird that this is pretty clean. Mm-hmm. But not a lot of tension building. Like it's kind of boring to me. The first thing I wrote down, and this is for you, especially in keeping with a lot of movies we've seen recently, the trauma trope.
Yeah.
That she's, going off on this this vacation, having experienced this trauma recently, having just
right.
been released from this this mental institution. She's traumatized by the accidental death of her baby, for which she feels responsible. Mm-hmm. What did you think of that, seeing that again? Did you write that down?
I did, yeah. So like the trauma aspect of this, the trauma sort of glorification or redemption, kind of is old hat at the moment for me. But since they were doing it back then too, it makes me revisit other films more modern in my mind that this is a theme that's been happening throughout the modern era of horror. So, but that said, I will give the film props on its really sadistic kind of uber gonzo twist at the end. It almost turns into a revenge film in the last 15 minutes of it. It's kind of, like you said, slow paced. The kills are off screen. We're just seeing the Podunk family stuck in the times devour, so to speak, the yuppies of modern times in the 80s, right? So yeah. But at the end, they throw in the little twist of like, well, the trauma's still very present and it breaks this woman, and she somehow is able to outthink everybody all of a sudden and kill them all, which it kind of makes me go like, whoa, okay, another one of those things where in the horror genre, I think we're constantly looking for that thing, that shock value, that that twist or whatever it may be. And their solution here was, this meek, damaged woman is going to all of a sudden go totally off the deep end and become a monster in herself. So, it's an interesting finale for me.
Yeah. I'd love to see, there's that idea that folks talk about. Stop remaking good movies.
Right. Right.
Stop redoing things that people actually liked, like the Point Break remake, and I'm sure
yes.
there's plenty of
yes.
others, but that's like a really good example. Mm-hmm. But start remaking bad movies.
Yes.
Like yeah. this is not very good objectively.
No.
But I would totally watch this again. You know, a redone version, especially if you can get like an old Oscar winning actor you know, some screen legends, female actress to play Ma and Pa. You know, who's the Porkins from the new Star Wars movies? Let's get him.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure. Oh, man. And that's, talk about like extra trauma that's in a, you know, today's audience would be super triggering. There's not a lot of gore, like you said. There are some bodies, there's some aftermath, that kind of stuff. But the thing that, you know, I'm more sensitive of now, I think all modern audiences are, is rape or whatever. And there's like a necrophiliac scene that kind of like sticks out in my mind of like, what, you know, like it went over the top for me there. It jumped the shark a little bit.
Yeah that's the one murder of the yuppies. I was gonna say the kids, you know, but the yuppies that isn't performed as like this childlike game, because there's the one guy who gets killed off the swing, there's the woman who gets like tied up and hanged by a jump rope. What was the third one?
He gets stabbed in the eye by a toy statue or whatever it was, like the
but that's that molestation of the dead girl,
right,
is, you know, relates to that repression. Mm-hmm. Of sexuality and the shame of it, and because the other brother is like watching, he's like, oh, I'm gonna tell Mom. There's another layer to it that's even more kind of disturbing than the actual act itself.
And they've been hinting throughout the movie that the kids have been incestuous with one another. Kids, we're talking, they're like, you know, in their 50s, right, or whatever.
That's like the creepy thing is all these this family, this psychopathic family, is a daughter or a sister, a daughter, mm-hmm. and these two brothers who are physically adults,
right?
And yet have been repressed into this like a sustained adolescence, this sustained childhood. So they are mentally, emotionally, she keeps talking about her baby, so I guess maybe she's what, 14, 15, but she's dressed like a little girl. It's very
they have her birth, quote unquote birthday, in there, and I think she's turning 12 or 13.
Oh,
it's,
my god,
it's like, oh, okay, they're young, they're mentally, they're young.
Very, very creepy. Again, like so much here that would be worth revisiting in a remake.
For sure.
A couple other things, just notes I threw out there that I'm just like, in terms of story,
mm-hmm.
I was just like, did they just forget about Paul at some point? Because they leave one of the guys at the campsite. He's like, you stay here, you know, guard the plane or whatever, and we'll go off and try to find help. And then he just like disappears for the rest of the movie until they find his dead body.
Right.
And like the characters, they're just waiting around, like waiting for, you know, oh, is this person on the boat gonna come? And Pa's like, you gotta have faith, you gotta trust in the Lord for deliverance or whatever. But nobody's like, hey, where's the nearest town? How do you get food? Like how did you get the stuff to make this cake? Like what, like, because they're the yuppies like break in.
Yeah, they walk in.
And they're playing with the record and the clothes and stuff. And then Ma and Pa show up, and nobody's like, hey, where were you just now? Like, mm-hmm. where, like, were you in town getting this food? Or, like, what, why were you not here? So, like, clearly they have some kind of access to help, and yet they're never like, hey, could we maybe get to wherever, you know, there's a town. There's gotta be one.
Oh man, and much like anything, there are plot holes galore if you really go digging hard, and that is one of them. We don't know exactly where they're at. Some supposedly some remote island off the coast, you know, close enough to Seattle, right? But it feels like at that time there'd be ferries, there may be a bridge, you know, who knows, that they would have access to, road access to. So, yeah, it's kind of a funny little oopsie, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's a contrivance that they came upon the house in the first place. Out of all the places that this seaplane, you know, had to emergency land, they happened to be close to this home. Right. And then the home is like, oh, we've had so many other people come through here and murdered them as well. And it's like, were these like hikers or how did they end up? Did their seaplane also malfunction? It doesn't really matter.
And they apparently had killed the guy with the boat long, long time ago. So that was a big lie no matter what. So yeah, they have to be getting supplies in some form or fashion.
Yeah. But it's just funny that at no point they're like, hey, could we maybe like find it rather than like waiting around for this one guy on the boat? Is there like some other way to get around here? And they're just like, nah, I guess we'll just hang out.
Just hang out.
And wait. And there's like no, the first guy dies, he gets launched off this swing onto the rocks, and they're just like, I guess we'll just keep hanging out here.
Yeah.
Despite this.
And that guy's
girlfriend. We're not going to go back to the campsite and tell Paul, like, hey, by the way, some guy died. We got to like really figure something out. Even though they don't necessarily know how it happened, it's still like, but like he was on a swing that they built. Like maybe this isn't the safest place to stay.
Yeah, for sure. And the it's also so much of the film has that kind of air of assumption to it. The like his girlfriend, right after the fact, they're just waiting around and she's the one who gets molested after death. And it's just I don't know, it's there's a lot of that in this film where you feel like it was a story or a plan put together by throwing darts at a board, like, and then they're gonna go there, you know, and like,
yeah,
okay, why?
So, yeah,
yeah, not too much of the why is being explored in any of this. So
yeah, at the center of it, there's the idea that okay, there's this psychopathic family, and they keep their children repressed in this childhood state, this you know, this arrested development, and they kill people who come onto their property, and that's a good idea. And then they're just like, okay, we'll just fill out the rest of it somehow. And they, you know, they each kind of die by these, you know, these screwed up versions of childhood games, which is cool. So yeah, but please somebody remake this and make it like Rob Zombie's version of this.
Oh man, I would
be, I'd love to, which it already kind of exists with like House of a Thousand Corpses
for
and stuff like that. But anyway,
oh, let me remake it. I'll remake it. Man, let's do this.
The rights have got to be pretty cheap, I think. Let's check it out. It's one of my favorite things, possibly, doing this podcast, when I get to watch a bad movie and yet there's still a core idea here that, like, thematically speaking, is actually really rich. And so as I thought about talking about the movie of this episode, I realized this is really in a subgenre of horror movies that has existed for a really long time and continues to be revisited. And some call it backwoods horror. And most of these movies involve city folk ending up somewhere in rural America or otherwise more remote or isolated parts of the country. And then they're murdered by locals. And that's pretty much the whole story. And we'll link this list that IMDb has that some user put together. But it's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Hills Have Eyes, Deliverance, X, Wrong Turn, House of a Thousand Corpses, The Strangers, The Old Dark House and Straw Dogs, but they don't take place in the U.S., but the remake of Straw Dogs does. 2000 Maniacs, Duel, Race with the Devil, Eaten Alive, Bloodstalkers, and Southern Comfort. I mean, this genre goes back like 70, 80 years at this point. Like, what do you think of this genre, and why is it so prevalent in horror?
I think understanding why people do what they do and the differences of where people come from is a rich theme in all genres of film, but horror has a special take on it. We can put forth the differences and really lean into the idea of don't judge a book by its cover before you read it, right? You know, whatever the saying is. And I think that is why it's so entertaining to watch, is to see maybe, you know, the rich or the wealthy or the whatever get put in their place by the elements, so to speak, and the people that live in these rural communities are part of the elements, I think. That's one of the big draws, in my opinion, to these kind of subgenre horror films.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely the appeal of these spaces, and you kind of talked about it when you talked about the appeal of shooting in the Northwest. That you know, some of these remote places have a sense of fear kind of baked in because they are so remote, they are so isolated, the places themselves. But it is interesting to me that, like, a central element of a lot of these movies is that folks in these communities are stuck in old ways and sometimes devoutly religious in a kind of world that's foreign to the more modern urban visitors. And there's always a kind of culture clash, and you see that in this movie, you know, with the smoking or the, oh, you're not married, so you can't sleep in the same room, and those kinds of prejudices. And the other way as well, the kids coming in and being like, oh, isn't this, like, funny that they listen to this old music and have these old clothes? But it's almost always the rural folks who are portrayed as creepy and strange and uneducated or racist and, of course, violent. So, like, why is that? And, like, do you feel like movies like this have had an effect on our assumptions about rural communities and people who prefer to live with these kinds of old traditions?
I think it's, especially during this time period, it was easier to hide in the rural parts of America. In the cities, murder was in the news all the time, access to those kind of things. But the what if, or the what's behind, what lurks in the dark kind of aspect, I think is always tied to the unknown. And for the longest time, I feel like a bulk of the country was unknown. And we can get into some of the economic or political, socio-political triggers that happened in recent years to signal some of these folks to come out of the woodwork and express themselves. For me, I feel like movies at this time, or movies in this genre, really try to focus on the unknown of rural lifestyle in the modern era, when you have conveniences now, the internet and all these kind of things, better access to shipping routes and all that kind of stuff. I feel like Amazon, for example, geez, you know, Amazon goes everywhere now, so it's hard to imagine finding these small islands of, you know, with that are inhabited by who knows what. Just so happens to be an old-time family on this one. I feel like it's really tied to not knowing what lies in the unpopulated areas of our culture and country.
Yeah, that's a good point. And obviously, in the more modern era, internet and increasingly with the socio-political divide. Like, there are, we'll get into this later, but there are kind of post-Trump horror movies that the conflict, this cultural conflict, is much more like at the forefront of what these movies are talking about. But yeah, I mean, it feels similar to me that this whole genre of horror movies of, like, portraying indigenous people as savages. There was a whole genre of movies that would do that, which would be totally unacceptable today. So, but why is this version so enduring? That's really interesting to me.
Yeah, I it's just my opinion, but I think it comes down to eat the rich mentality. I mean, that goes through all genres of entertainment. We like to see the fall, you know, and these people were well-to-do. Now, the story specifically, again, is not super put together in a way that it's digestible by a large audience will understand it. But, you know, having somebody that suffered extreme trauma and then putting them into more trauma and then breaking them to the point, you know, that's sort of boiling it down to its essence. In my mind, much like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, much like Deliverance, man, it's just done with different flavors, I guess, in this one. Because Ma and Pa and the family are not super scary to look at. They're not. They're just a little weird, and they're not even super creepy. If I'm being totally honest, I feel like they get creepy as the film progresses, but not in any sort of way that made me go really suspect them. Like I would if you walked into, if you met this family in American Gothic, or you met the family in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know what I mean? You'd be like, oh, I'm not going to go into that Texas house, but I'll go into this, you know, small Pacific Northwest island house.
They seem polite. Yeah, I definitely see your comments on Eat the Rich, although, I mean, yeah, these people feel like yuppies. I guess I would say, I would phrase that differently as, like, privileged.
Mm. There you go.
You know, the folks in this genre tend to come off as privileged, and sort of the assumption that, well, this is the way I live. You know, in this city with these, you know, with my radio, which, you know, they don't even have a radio in this isolated house, and a cell phone and a car and whatever. And obviously, you know, enough wealth to charter a seaplane for six of their friends, you know, afford.
And one of them can pilot it. You know, it's like, oh, wow. You know,
Exactly. Yeah. Can have the time to take flight lessons. Mm-hmm. So yeah, certainly a level of privilege and of ignorance, and you see them when they walk in to the home, and this kind of a cultural tourism, you know, kind of thing, where they're dressing up as this, and isn't this fun how, like, these people live like this? It's so weird and kooky. They are immediately apologetic about it.
That's true.
So I will give them that. And then it's just that kind of culture clash with the smoking and the, you know, I feel bad for the first guy who gets launched off the swing because they're like, hey, do you want to try our game? And he's not like, that looks silly and dumb. I'm going to go like hang out and read a comic book or something. Like, he's like, yeah, sure, I'll try it. Like, most of them seem like, yeah, we'll hang with you. We'll do what you tell us to. It's no big deal. And yet they still get killed. So that's sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm still like, wow, these people are still just, you know, inherently evil.
Yeah.
And that's
misguided for sure.
I mean, there are so many other movies in this genre where they're just like, oh, they're cannibalistic. There is this like evil lurking beneath the unknown. And there's a good article from the Nerdist that I sent you not too long before we recorded, so no worries if you didn't read it. But I did just like this quote in here. This is Ty Gooden in 2021. Talks about like why small towns and rural settings are perfect for horror, and he discusses they discuss this sense of othering, which I think is definitely inherent to this genre. They write, in many ways, small towns, specifically those in rural areas, are othered by people who have never lived in one. And we can talk about that because this was made by a Brit. Residents are stereotyped and judged for choosing, quote unquote, to live there, despite it not always being a choice. Small town residents don't all lack intelligence, speak with a thick accent, issue progressive beliefs, or hate everyone who isn't from their home. And all small towns and rural areas are not, quote unquote, shit kicker places for people with no future. And they also write, you know, this location may lack resources. It's sequestered from nearby society, no major city nearby, feeling, you know, there's this feeling that there's nowhere to run, and that death and mayhem, I think, as you said, or kind of alluded to, stuff that happens in these forgotten pockets won't necessarily attract attention as they might in cities. So I like that there is this element of judgment, I think, that goes into setting these kinds of stories in rural America, even if stuff like Stranger Things, our central characters also live in the town. You know, and are also plagued by this town. I think there was a Fear Street movie that the article mentions that came out a couple of years ago that does the same thing, where there is somebody in this town who doesn't want to accept that the town is cursed and is going to get to the bottom of it and is going to save this town from whatever the curse is. So anyway, I thought their writing on the sense of othering was really informative to the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense to me. I feel like that's saying the same thing in a different way. You know what I mean? I feel like anything that is different and unknown is scary in the horror genre, we use that a lot. And this one, this subgenre, so happens to glorify and showcase the differences and unknowns of different ways of life, right? You know, so the, I guess the othering thing is, yeah, spot on to me.
Which leads me to another question. On the flip side, why aren't there any movies about rural Americans visiting a city and being hunted and murdered and eaten? Like, that is interesting to me because, of course, from a rural perspective, coming to town would be just as scary.
Right.
Right. The these kinds of unknowns of, you know, kind of having to adjust to, you know, a modern way of living, that can be really scary, too. So why don't those horror movies exist?
I think the stories do exist in different genres, not necessarily horror specifically. Like you can have the Beverly Hillbillies, you know, as a, you know, from rural to city and encounter problems, you know, or whatever. It's a, you know, comedy fun time, but it's still that sort of commentary on it. They end up preferring, you know, they wish they would have gone back or stayed in their home in the Midwest. But I don't know. It could be a lot of things. It could be, to be honest, filming in cities is harder. It is more expensive. So the art form itself exponentially increases when you're needing to film in a very populated area.
That's a good point, actually. That just, like, you know, as I mentioned, horror is so cheap to make.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming this movie looks like it was pretty cheap to make.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of these movies are made with very, very low budgets. And where is it cheap to film? In the country. So that's a really good point. That is just like, well, what's the cheapest way we can make this? Even if they would have liked to do this flip side version that you know, we're talking about.
Yeah.
It'd just be too expensive.
Right. Yeah.
That's such a great point.
Yeah, but nowadays it could be something. I mean, I feel like it didn't quite go this territory, but the new Evil Dead movie, Rise of Evil Dead, I think it was called.
You know,
Evil Dead Rise, thank you. Takes place in, you know, a high rise building that is being condemned and shut down. It's like, and then Barbarian, I feel like, is another one where she's visiting Detroit and the city's running down, and there's when things run down and creepy things seep into the woodwork, you know, or whatever. It's like, I feel like they are doing it in a way, but not as clear and thematically forceful as like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre or whatever. We don't see a family of cannibals living in a high rise New York apartment and luring victims up there. You know, I don't know. It'd be interesting. Now, speaking, and this is another podcast someday, maybe, Portland specifically used to have like the highest active serial killers per capita, I guess, in the U.S. So
Portland or Oregon?
I think Portland specifically. They were talking. There was, so I ran the, and this is a side note. We're going to go down a tangent if you want, but I ran the Portland City Marathon back in 2015.
Congratulations!
Yeah, thanks. Woo.
Well done.
And the guy who was running at the time was telling me about, oh yeah, you run by the containers that where they found all the trophies that the such serial killer. And I was like, what? You know, there's a lot of that here apparently, and I don't know why. I mean, Dexter, for crying out loud, the show Dexter ended up, he's like in the Pacific Northwest, the original show. Yeah, he leaves and goes back to the Pacific Northwest. He's in, I think, Miami at you know, during the show, but he eventually escapes to the Pacific Northwest.
And we also talked about, in terms of different kinds of horror that take place in the cities, and I love that you brought up Evil Dead Rise because we saw it together.
Yeah.
A very poor version of it, tinted in like purple.
Yeah.
You remember that? Like
it was all messed up. And that I guess, shape our opinion of it a little bit.
I was going to say color our opinion to make the pun. Yeah, those are good examples of city-based horror in this kind of vein, mm-hmm. That have a different kind of social commentary, I think, yeah. Barbarian and Evil Dead Rise specifically, and then also I think the recent Candyman mm-hmm. remake,
yep.
Which I didn't see, but I think was tinged by like this theme of gentrification or something like that.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
I did want to note, while horror movies, and this is more for, you know, for our listeners, thank you, mm-hmm. While horror movies tend to show rural America as strange and dangerous and evil, dramas or movies in other genres tend to show rural America as like inspirational and liberating. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about a handful, and there's also one that I'll mention that we haven't talked about yet, but American Flyers is all about finding liberation and strength by going west on this road trip and this bike race and finding family and finding strength within yourself. American Splendor, finding beauty in the mundanity of the Midwest, holding up this like working class hero, especially, you know, showing him on these segments with, was it Letterman, I think, in that movie,
mm.
where he's like talking shit to the city folk in the audience. Great. American Heart, another Seattle movie. Jeff Bridges' character feels held down by the systems in the city and the kind of systems that landed him in jail, and he's striving to start over in Alaska. It's this very like aspirational kind of movie to find freedom in rural America. American Outlaws, about defending your land against greedy city folk, with Jesse James as the hero. American Honey, where this group of young people find a kind of home and community together, traveling all around America. So it's interesting that different genres kind of take this idea in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I find it a very compelling subgenre for sure in horror.
And we kind of talked about this a little bit already, but you know, there is, you know, maybe a correlation between the kind of narratives in this genre and the kind of narratives that the media promotes or that we've mm-hmm. been experiencing certainly over the past 5-10 years. Do you think this movie is a little interesting to think about in the context of today?
I think so. I feel like it's definitely paralleling some of the things we fear and are seeing in a societal breakdown in almost in a microcosm of a movie. The us versus them, the dividing. Like they both of these groups of people live in the Pacific Northwest. You know, one lives in Seattle, one lives on an island, right? But they still view each other as enemies or whatever. Now, whenever, I think that's more based on a moral code for the family that lives on the island rather than you're not American, you're city folk. Mm-hmm. I think it's more along the lines of, well, they're exposing our children to hedonistic ideas. Mm-hmm. They must die, you know, whatever. but in terms of today, I think we didn't touch on this yet, but I feel like it is ultimately filmmaking is an art form. And here's my politically correct answer. I don't believe it is an artist's job to force a perspective on folks. It is their interpretation, their creation that expresses their own themes or feelings. And then the audience is the one that interprets it, right? So, and puts their own meaning on it. But, yeah, I guess to get back to the question, it's a compelling idea that I think definitely, you know, kind of pokes the bear, pokes the tension a little bit in terms of what's happened in our country the past, I don't know, 5 years, you know, 6 years. So,
Yeah, we do, I think specifically us, you know, us two, mm-hmm. living in Portland or nearby Portland, we see this divide very often in our news media, or if you spend any time on Twitter in the comments section of like K2 News or The Oregonian, as I do, folks in more suburban and rural areas are being fed the idea that cities are dangerous and
right.
especially a city like Portland that's run by Democrats. You know, you've got fentanyl and homelessness and shoplifting and car break-ins and shootings. And Portland's a big punching bag for conservatives.
Sure.
And like, yes, violent crime exists in Portland and other cities run by Democrats, but it's not unique to cities.
Right.
But that's so that sense of othering does work both ways. Mm-hmm. You get folks around here saying like, oh, Portland is so dangerous, but have you actually spent any time there? No, no, I would never go there.
Yeah, yeah.
And on the flip side, this, you know, the kind of MAGA movement, this mm-hmm. there is this overt message to return to an America of a bygone era. And the media, news media specifically, definitely enhances those voices on both sides and does more, I think, than, as you said, than any art form ever could,
right?
Any creative art form or fiction could, to enhance that divide and rile people up on both sides. And I will say, you know, it's not just the media, but folks in power who are also mm-hmm. fighting this culture war, this like ongoing feud between Gavin Newsom and Ron DeSantis. I'm like, can we stop? Can we like do things that actually help people? It's really annoying.
Yeah.
I think it's so like, yeah. Anyway, I have my problems on that. But yeah, there are folks out there who are banning books and banning a more thorough education of history or gender and sexuality and banning mm-hmm. therapies that help trans kids or banning trans kids from playing sports, basically banning the existence of trans individuals. And of course, the most obvious example of like taking us back in time, like the overturning of Roe v. Wade. So,
right.
Certainly, I see the way in which, I don't know, life imitates or art imitates life, imitates art. But I do. I would tend to agree with you that, especially given your argument about budgets, like we just wanted to make a story,
right.
You know, we just wanted to make this fun idea. We had this idea, like, it would be crazy if these people lived in the woods and just, like, killed people who came onto their property
because
like, we want to isolate ourselves. We prefer the way we live. And that's, you know, that's okay. And they want to protect their children from the evil influence of the city folk.
Yeah, it's a theme that, you know, I feel like is what's the word I'm trying to look for? Timeless, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of theme of a family isolating to protect their from outside whatever perspectives is present in all forms of film in all genres since the beginning of movie making. So I don't think it's going to go away either. I think a lot of people enjoy exploring it and want to share their perspective.
Yeah, I certainly don't think this trend is going away anytime soon of the urban-rural
mm-hmm.
coming into conflict with each other, especially in more overt ways.
Yeah,
with more overt sociopolitical commentary. In fact, I discussed on this podcast a couple movies that feel like MAGA-inspired horror thrillers, American Carnage, which is basically like a Latinx Get Out, American Insurrection, and American Refugee. And in fact, Refugee has like almost word for word, not word for word, but beat for beat, a similar dinner scene in which the religious patriarch gets upset when someone doesn't say amen after saying grace. I saw that happen in this movie and I'm like, oh my God, I don't think they're ripping off this movie, but like,
no,
we're playing on such the same idea. So like this trend is as relevant now or this kind of, conflict is as relevant now as it was 35 years ago.
Yep. Absolutely. I agree.
I never saw The Hunt. Did you see The Hunt?
I did. Yeah.
That's an Eat the Rich, right? That's like a... Or is it... No, the rich are capturing the working class to do like a Most Dangerous Game.
Yes, there you go.
That's what it is. Yeah. We should highlight maybe a movie that like subverts this.
Yes.
In a really interesting way.
We really enjoy this one.
Talk about it.
Well, Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. It is one of those few where the hillbillies are nice and they're trying to be friendly, but the preconceived notions of the I'll call them yuppies. I think they're kids, college kids, and whatnot, coming to the cabin puts themselves in in violent, dangerous, and ultimately horrible deaths. And Tucker and Dale are the victims in this, and they are victims in the fact that they're witnessing it, and they're trying to help and save and prevent, and nothing goes their way. Because that's commentary in itself, maybe, that they're kind of bumpkins and not too intelligent. So, but it's a wonderful horror comedy that I feel like really is aware of this othering and tries to flip it on its head.
Yeah. I just remember the one scene towards the beginning where he's like, the whole reason they have this interaction in the first place is like, one of the guys thinks one of the college girls is like pretty and like wants to go flirt with her, but he has no idea how to do that in like a socially acceptable way. And he just, he comes off as like the creep at the like quintessential, gas station.
Yeah.
Who comes off as just so creepy and dangerous. And, God, I really have to rewatch that movie.
Yeah.
Doesn't somebody, one of them like slips off a rock cause she sees them like watching her like jump into the river or something.
I forget.
Or they're just like fishing and she thinks that they're watching her.
Yeah.
I think that's what it is. But yeah, it's like more movies like that interrogate these prejudices as opposed to movies that play on these stereotypes.
Right. Right.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
So I love that we ended it on more of a comic note there. But we got to transition to our favorite segments in these episodes, American Moments.
They're playing our song.
What do you got?
Oh, man. Well, again, coming from the horror perspective, stabbing a guy in the eye with a statue of I think it's somebody riding on a horse. that seems pretty American to me.
That's great.
Also, what is the Paw's favorite weapon? It's a double barrel shotgun. Coming to my house, I got a shotgun. That's very American, I feel.
Classic. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I love both of those. You get this segments. I love that. Fantastic.
Yeah.
I had to pick out the like generic rock music that they're listening to in the woods, the like royalty free.
Right.
And you know, stuff being made on the cheap. I get it. It reminded me so much of Saved by the Bell, but I guess because this was made by Brits, this is like the British idea of what generic American rock music sounds like in the 80s.
Right.
That's
right.
A great moment. And of course, I have to call out the American flag hanging in the cabin.
There you go.
We didn't even mention two of the sons or the two sons named after old presidents.
Right. There you go.
Teddy and Woody.
Mm hmm.
I didn't. The girl is Fanny.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that was a reference to. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, maybe?
I kind of doubt it.
I definitely doubt. That was later.
Yeah.
And a fun fact for listeners, this movie, American Gothic, joins Wet Hot American Summer and American Dreams as another film on our list to only have one award nomination or win. This one is for Yvonne DiCarlo for Best Actress at the 1987 Fanta Festival, the oldest and one of the most important Italian festivals devoted to genre movies, science fiction, fantasy, and horror.
Hmm.
That's all I got for this episode. Jason, where can people see your stuff? And you know, thank you so much for all the commentary and discussion of horror movies and for always being willing to go to the theater and see horror movies with me. But
heck yeah, man.
Where can people see your stuff?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me again, man. And you can see my first short film called Killing Time, horror film, on reveal.com. I just finished up, a couple years ago, we finished up She Picked Me, and that's done its film festival tour. That should be releasing soon. Also, I wrote and directed a film called Tabitha, which is part of a feature-length film horror anthology titled Symphony, a Clubhouse Horror Anthology. Symphony is now available to stream for free on Tubi. So those are where my things are. We've got My team and I have big plans for this next year as well, to bring in a Pacific Northwest inspired horror anthology. And we have the writers under contract already. Hopefully SAG will figure out its stuff and we will be able to do this in 2024.
Fingers crossed. I think that's going to be great. As we talked about, just one of the best places in America to shoot horror. So what better than to create a horror anthology with all Pacific Northwest crew? I'm looking forward to that. That is Symphony, S-I-N.
Yes.
Symphony. Great title. We'll link all this stuff in the description of the episode. Thank you so much again. That's a wrap on American Gothic. Thank you everyone for listening. If you like what we're doing, please give us a rating, leave a positive review, follow us on Instagram @AmericanScenePod, and we'll see you next time.